It's the CFI Gossip Edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Engineering Ice Enzymes, Black Hole of Charity, Jesus Beats a Baby, Untrusting Atheist, and CFI Descents into Darkness. Let's begin episode 143.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
This is Don, your political science philosopher.
And Jenna, your lab rat biochemist.
And pancake eating champion.
Turns out.
Yes.
That was an interesting conversation that we had before we went on air.
Oh, yes. And if we could promote a particular restaurant, I'm sure Jenna would. But there is a place out there, apparently, that makes the best pancakes in the entire universe. And Jenna is the pancake-eating champion of that particular place. Three cheers.
We digress.
But speaking of having a big name and getting lots of good stuff, tasty stuff, money.
Yeah. Money's tasty. Well, CITR recently had the fun drive last week. It turns out it was actually a pretty big success.
Excellent.
Now, as I understand it, there's
Is that why we're back here today, Ethan?
That's you why we're back.
Gave me that pink slip that you weren't quite sure. You know, should I give it, should I not?
We just didn't know, but it turns out things are looking good. Now, the numbers are still getting all added up and calculated, so we don't have an exact number just yet. But it looks like CITR brought in about $25,000.
Does that mean they're going to double our salary?
From nothing to nothing, yes.
Excellent. The way I said it sounds so much better.
Yeah. Well, we're also still calculating all the donors to Radio Free Thinker as well. We got a small list so far, but we expect that to get a few more as the different avenues of donating all coalesce and we figure out the exact number. But for the time being, let's give it a good thanks to Peter, Fred, Harold, Daphne, Leif, and Marlene for donating to Radio Free Thinker. We really appreciate your support, and CITR is obviously much better off now thanks to these people.
That's Delphine, not Daphne.
Delphine?
It's okay.
Okay.
I forgive you.
That's okay.
Okay.
Well, we have to give a really great show today, don't we?
Yes. Well, you know, as in part of the spirit of giving, I thought we would delve into what I unbiasedly call the black hole of charity.
Completely unbiased. I checked.
Completely. One thing that Christian apologists always bring up is that, you know, say what you may, religious institutions provide social services by way of charity work. As we approach the big giving time of the year, and I must point out as a good communist that it's not really giving time, it's a corporate grab, and karma's resist temptation, you're only funding the subjugation of yourself, enough of the leftist right.
Also totally unbiased.
Yes. So if we scan the horizon, we see a plethora of charitable organizations that are asking for our donations. Again, thank you for those. We are the good ones, not the bad ones. So they might do their good works. One of the giants in the industry is the church. Regardless of faith, religious charitable donations account for about one of every $3 donated, and twice more than its closest competitor, which is school.
Now, question, does this include such organizations that are religious affiliates, but that's not their main message that they give out to the public, such as World Vision? That is a religious affiliate, yes?
In theory,
I think something like the
Salvation Army. So I'm wondering if that's included.
For example, Salvation Army, I think, would be covered.
Yeah.
Any religious organization.
Because I feel that is a religious organization.
Yeah, okay, so that's a great
under the umbrella, anyway.
The studies that I was looking at essentially didn't count Jenna's phone. NGOs, which I think things like World Vision would qualify as NGOs, as opposed to churches.
Right.
So, again, this seems to be basically with church donations and donations given via the church.
Gotcha.
Which is important because how is this money spent? I don't know. Actually, I do know because I looked it up. First thing we should note is that a significant amount of church donations do not actually go to charitable works at all, but to the upkeep of church property and the support of church staff. This will vary greatly depending on, you know, the kind of tithing that you do to the church. In one case study, it was actually worked out to only be about 5% of the money donated was actually given to charitable works. And this was a reputable sort of Catholic church sort of institution, right?
And sorry, just to clarify, is this money given throughout the year or money given specifically around the holiday season?
Given throughout the year.
Okay. So that includes sort of the weekly contributions to the plate?
Well, the numbers that I was looking at were people who essentially were getting tax donations for their charitable donation.
Okay.
So this would not include people who
like
donated
Chuck and Toonies into the plate.
Things. Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, no, I don't think that would count because you wouldn't get a...
That's what I'm saying. It wouldn't be included.
So, that being said, let's not forget that a significant amount of charity work is also done by, you know, televangelists and stuff is actually quite fraudulent. Now, not that secular charities can't be fraudulent. There's been more than a number that have been out there. But because these are sort of churches, they tend to get special status with regards to tax law. And whenever you try and investigate them or interfere with them, they always get to wave the religious freedom card. How dare you interfere in my, you know, constitutional right for religious freedom, which makes it a lot harder to sort of track down, pin down, or get rid of religious fraudulent charities than it would be for secular fraudulent charities.
I think the problem is actually made worse by the fact that one of the qualifications for being a charity in Canada is you have to fall into these different categories. I think one of them is education, but one of them is religious. And, you know, the Salvation Army and World Vision, those types of organizations fall into that category. And that's one of the few ways, like out of three ways, to get tax-exempt status for your donations. So they really have a monopoly, not just on giving through, say, the Catholic Church, but giving through charities as well.
Well, and as I'm going with this fraudulent theme, right, as you point out, just to be a church qualifies you as sort of non-tax status and that sort of thing as a charity. So, I mean, you just have to say, listen, I'm a religion, give me your money. And although there are a few, you know, hoops you got to go through to qualify as a religion and as a church, it's a much, much lower bar than you do with the other ones. Not to mention that a lot of religious institutions, because they can sort of pull upon each other. If I started up a Catholic mission in Vancouver here and claim charitable donations, that's a lot easier because I can say, listen, I'm part of this other institution, which means I gain their sort of cover as being legit. Whereas if I said, let's start Radio Free Thinker charitable institution, it'd be like, well, we need 16 years of financial documentation.
Yeah, let's see your books.
Yeah, you know, we need all this extra stuff that you'd probably be given more or less of a pass on if you were a religious church, or at least you could sort of leech onto. Of course, another aspect that plays into this is the whole idea of efficiency. And now I know I'm putting on my utilitarian cap here, but again, there are a wide spectrum of results here. But it's important to note that all church donations are really secondary in nature. That is, if I donate to, let's say, a school bake sale for them to send kids to CERN, because, of course, every kid wants to go to the collider in Europe, right? That's sort of a direct donation, i.e. there's no real intermediaries taking a little bit piece of the pie. Some secular charities, of course, will have layers of management, but they will almost never have as many layers as a church will. So it seems that almost in every instance, it's more efficient to donate to a result-specific charity than to a church. And again, there's a spectrum of things, right? Because, I mean, you get some, like PETA is a big one out there, which is supposed to be a charity to help animal rights, but it's often been criticized that it's just there to fatten the wallets of people who are in the organization. So this isn't a super blanket sort of thing that all and nothing, but it is far more likely that you're going to get this sort of institutional drag, this sapping of resources for non-things in a religious institutions than you will in a secular institutions, but not exclusively.
And this might be a tiny, tiny bit off topic, but as far as, those different layers and the different things that are actually being supported by the donations, I've heard a lot of criticisms of things like where you get incentives to donate and that kind of thing. And specifically what pops to mind is the BCSPCA has always they seem to have these really large sort of like, and mugs and t-shirts and calendars and, you know, a free picture of a kitten that calls you on the phone every morning, you know. Yeah. But talking to to some people that are actually in the fundraising business, most of those things that people are really wary about donating because of, they've done the market research to figure out that the dollars spent on the incentives, at the end of the day, you actually still end up getting more that goes to the cause by using those incentives than by just soliciting donations without a promise of anything in return.
Well, I mean, like right here, I mean, one of the things that we were giving away is this swag. Right?
Yeah.
And I mean, again, counterintuitively, you think, well, wouldn't it be better if we just kept the money we spent on the swag and just asked for the money? But human psychology being as screwy as it is, people are much more willing to give if they think they're getting. In the same way that charities, in the same off topic but same area, giving, you'd think that, you know, if I was donating to save your life, I'd give a dollar. If I was going to save a million people's life, I'd give $1 million, right? Because, I mean, it's much more proportional.
Thanks, but, John.
Yeah. But you'd be happy to know that the way human psychology works is I'm much, much less likely to give money to help a lot of people, mm-hmm. and a lot more likely to help a single people, which is why, as sickening as it is in so many ways, when you see these ads on TV, see little Jose, isn't Jose suffering? Wouldn't you want to make his day better or whatever? They're prying away at your psyche to get at your deep mm-hmm. animalistic instincts, where you'll help an individual mm-hmm. a lot more and a lot consistently than you will a whole group, even though logically that makes no sense.
However, as you mentioned, that's different than lining the pockets of just people in the organization.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And we should point out that we actually didn't pay any money for the prizes that we gave away. They were donated to us by the James Randi Educational Foundation. So we didn't expend any resources on those.
And we would like to thank the James Randi Foundation.
Absolutely. Sure would.
But of course, now this all leads... Okay, so let's say a lot of this stuff, because there's big spectrums and all that sort of thing, it leads us to the theological elephant in the room. Why do churches do charity work? The prime and exclusive purpose of churches are to...
charitable work.
Save souls. And to do this, they must convert people to the faith. That is, from a moral standpoint, secular charities are doing their good deeds to make the world a better place, to relieve suffering. Churches, on the other hand, do this more as a side effect. Why don't I donate to the Salvation Army or the church soup kitchen? Not because I don't think they do any good in the community. They do. But when I give money to them, I'm helping them to do their primary purpose, and that's proselytize, and proselytize to the needy and the downtrodden. $100 billion a year plus in the United States is wasted on church charities to allow them to take advantage of the poor in need of a meal, the addicted to recover, and I might point out, recover by replacing one addiction, drugs, with another addiction, religion, or in any number of other ways using human suffering to promote their theological agenda. I think most religious people think they're doing good, but if you crunch the numbers, you're better off giving to your local BC Food Bank, Oxfam, Amnesty International, Doctors Without Borders. There's a whole list of subjects out there that you can give to that, A, are providing direct donations to the particular good you're wanting to do, and B, doesn't have this extra baggage that's lying around.
So, Don, what you're saying then is that religious charities...
is a big black hole.
A big black hole.
And, you know, that metaphor works out so good because, I mean, one, I mean, I'm kind of implying you're wasting your money by giving to charities because of these various reasons I've given you. But again, a lot of these institutions don't actually have to tell you how or where they're spending their money specifically. I mean, they are charities and they're supposed to have their books open to a certain degree, but the actual amount they spend on missionary work, right, which is the one thing that they say is one of their charities, is we're helping to build water pumps in Africa. We're trying to educate the poor people in the Sudan or what have you. But these are monies given to X mission. And how much of that money is actually spent on education versus, again, this other, their primary business is proselytizing. Again, it's kind of a black box too.
Well, it seems to me like sort of the gap that I see as far as some of the things that the secular community is able to provide for their members compared to the religious community. So in a lot of churches and whatnot, it's not even so much the religious message that people are going for, so much as the community and community support that's offered, as well as this opportunity to sort of reflect on how you are influencing the world once a week, that isn't sort of there in the secular community. I'm kind of seeing the same thing as far as things like you were saying, soup kitchens and that kind of thing, where that domain really is dominated by the Salvation Army. And I mean, I used to volunteer at a soup kitchen that served three meals a day, 6 days a week, and then on Sundays they'd serve two meals a day. And they just had truckloads of food donated from Costco and Safeway and whatnot. And it seems like there really isn't a secular option to fill that niche that really is a need. So,
well, that point, Jenna, is part of what we're going to be talking a little bit about later on in the show when we discuss CFI's recent troubles, because that very issue is not front and center, but it's percolating mm-hmm. In the thinking of a lot of volunteers with CFI.
And actually, I'm going to push back a little bit. I think part of it, too, is the traditional image that churches get. Because, again, I donate to the BC Food Bank, which is not associated with any religious institution.
Right.
I hope so. If anyone wants to correct us, please send any comments to info@radiofreethinker.com.
Almost close.
Yeah. But again, so maybe a takeaway message from all this, so we can go to a commercial break, is, okay, atheists obviously in general are not going to want to give to any religious thing. Great. But what about those people out there who are either agnostic or who are religious and skeptical? I mean, that's not a contradiction most times. What I basically would say is that you need to divide your donations that you want to give away into sort of three pots. One pot, I want to give this money because I want to keep the upkeep of the church, I want to keep the priest, preacher, whomever, in business. Two, I want to do proselytizing because if you're religious, you probably believe in religion. This is the second pot of money I'm going to donate to do missionary work or what have you, and be upfront about it. This is what we're doing. But take that third pot of money. This is the money I want to give because people are suffering, people are hungry, people are starving, and they need help. And give that to a secular charity that is directed at the issue that you think is most important in your community.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, you cover all your bases, and you're being as effective as you can with your charitable donations.
Well, that's well said, Don.
Absolutely.
We'll go to a commercial break and be back with more on Radio Freethinker.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
We'd like to take a moment to thank businesses who have made generous donations to Fund Drive 2011. Thank you to Fortune Sound Club, Lotus Land Tattoo, and Sanitary Electric Tattoo Company for helping us continue to provide quality alternative programming from 2011 and into the future.
We'd also like to thank our volunteer sponsors, Bilo Foods and Ethical Bean, for keeping our volunteers sated and caffeinated.
We here at CITR cannot do without your support, so thank you. If you'd like to donate to CITR's Fund Drive 2011, call 604-822-8648. That's 604-822-8648. Or go online to citr.ca/funddrive today. Get up, stand up, get up.
The best tool ever devised for understanding how the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We're back on Radio Freethinker here on CITR. So, Jenna.
Yes.
Tell us a bit about engineering enzymes.
Well, I would love to tell you a little bit about engineering enzymes because there have been some really nifty steps in that direction that happened just this week.
Hold it. Before we start, what the hell is an enzyme?
So, an enzyme is a protein that is... proteins are kind of like long chains of amino acids. You can kind of think of them as sort of charm bracelets. So the chains are all the same, but then they have all these different side chains sticking out that interact with each other. And so you can imagine with lots of different kinds of charms, they can be put in all kinds of different combinations. And you can get this wide variety of different kinds of molecules. Okay. And they fold into a specific shape, as we'll talk a little bit about. And they're this thing that makes an enzyme and not just any other protein, is that it catalyzes a chemical reaction. So it speeds up a chemical reaction that might take millennia to happen on its own and makes it happen in, you know, tenths or hundredths or thousandths or millionths of seconds.
Sort of like yeast breaking down sugar into alcohol. They have enzymes that break the sugar apart. And on one hand, you get food for the bug and you get, well, food for the rest of us in the form of alcohol.
Well, and it's also how our bodies break down absolutely everything we eat. So we use them all the time. Your body's full of them. And you've heard me rant and rave about their incredible abilities before, and you'll hear it again because really, they're really amazing. These little proteins, they can do all kinds of really crazy chemistry. So in order to accomplish these specific chemical tasks, they have evolved really precisely over thousands of years.
Not millions?
Sometimes, but I mean, it depends on some reactions can actually evolve over tens or hundreds of years. So there are actually reactions that have evolved since humans started creating specific chemicals that there previously were not any reactions to actually transform, and now there are. But so it varies. So we'll say from tens of years to thousands of years, this evolution has taken place to make these enzymes just perfectly specialized at what they do. And they have this specificity and chemical capacity that's basically necessary to keep all biological systems, including ours, alive and ticking. So, of course, scientists with their big egos, just kidding, are not going to be outdone by natural selection. Oh, no. They have to go ahead and make their own enzymes.
When will they learn?
So a group of scientists from the University of Michigan reported this week in Nature Chemistry that they've managed to create an enzyme de novo. So that means from scratch, like a cake, not from a box. And that this enzyme is able to perform the same chemical reaction as one of our own enzymes.
Doesn't that seem redundant? I mean, if we already have one that does it, why would they make another one that does the same thing?
Well, I will get to that. It's actually a really important thing as far as proof of principle of this enzyme engineering concept. So firstly, let's talk about what enzyme the scientists actually created. So they made this whole new enzyme, which its activity is based on human carbonic anhydrase 2. That's what it's called. This enzyme takes carbon dioxide and water, and it spits out carbonate and protons. So this is sort of the one of the reactions that takes place in carbonated soda and that kind of thing. But like all enzymes, the natural carbonic anhydrase that we have has a very specific shape, and it contains a small location called the active site, and this is where the chemistry actually happens. But the whole shape of the enzyme is really important to be able to support that active site. And enzymes and proteins in general, I mentioned them as these long chains. When they exist just as long chains, they don't do squat. You really need this specific shape, and that's what gives all proteins their functionality.
I've always envisioned them as Christmas lights that have been rolled up into a ball. They have this sort of weird geometry, and you can't really pull them apart, but they fit in the box somehow perfectly.
Yeah, they do. And I like that example because you have the different color of the Christmas lights. I also like the charm bracelet example because you have the different shapes, and that's what's really important about the different side chains that exist on each link, because they can bind to different things.
If one of the enzymes isn't working, do all the other enzymes not work?
All the other side chains sometimes.
And buy the one enzyme that you need to plug into the stream of enzymes?
I think what you're actually referring to is the amino acids that make up the enzyme. But in some cases, yeah, you can knock one out and the whole thing is screwed and doesn't do a darn thing. But sometimes you can, you know, like the newer Christmas light strings where one is dead and it's A-OK and you're really excited. Some are like that.
This strikes me as one of those, you know, gene therapy things, right? Whereas you can either get a malformed protein, but it still more or less does the same thing, or you get one that's just won't do what it did originally, and then you get Alzheimer's or some weird thing like that.
Well, okay,
but
so
we digress.
Not actually that much, because this is actually sort of what scientists have been doing for years and years, is studying how enzymes work by mutating them. One little amino acid and or Christmas bulb, depending on our
analogy
at a time, And then seeing how that changes the activity of the enzyme and seeing whether changing that one makes it fall apart and seeing whether changing that one makes it not perform its chemistry or perhaps perform slightly different chemistry. However, so that's sort of taking something that's fully formed by the process of natural selection and then altering it to pick it apart.
So what the heck did these Michigan people do?
They came up with an entirely new shape. So they started basically building it from the ground up. They built a totally new scaffold, which is what we call sort of the overall shape of the protein, and stuck in an area that kind of looks a bit like the carbonic anhydrase active site, which is where that chemistry happens. And the result was it actually works. Well, I mean, it's able to perform the same carbon dioxide transformation and another reaction that carbonic anhydrase catalyzes as well.
Okay, now if you say this word that you're going to say
yes,
correctly, I'm going to give you a penny.
Okay. Apparently Don's reading my notes. So the question is, how well does this Franken enzyme do what it was literally designed to do?
That sounded harder on paper, but okay. Yeah. Franken enzyme.
Franken enzyme. In any case, this new, brand new enzyme that these scientists designed all the way from scratch works about 550 times less well than the natural enzyme. But to be fair, I mean, natural evolution had a lot longer to work on it.
And a lot more money.
They got a ton of donations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So as you kind of argued at the beginning, Don, this type of research is sort of completely unnecessary, you know, wasting money on reinventing the wheel, quite literally, if we're going to call the wheel our enzyme. So why would you ever spend tons of time and resources on designing an enzyme from scratch that is less efficient than an enzyme that actually already exists?
Oh, I know. I've been listening to the Tea Party. It's so that intellectual elites will be able to fatten their pockets and somehow deceive the rest of the people on some sort of liberal agenda that's intended to bring communism to the United States.
Now we've learned that we should never listen to Don. This argument, as well as, you know, the argument in general that it's a waste of time, I would argue is totally wrong. This work is an incredibly interesting and important step forward in our understanding of how enzymes work. So you can tinker with an engine all you want, but you don't really understand one, or so I'm told, until you put it together from the individual pieces. So the same is true for enzymes. By starting from scratch and designing this protein all the way from the bottom up, these scientists are testing our understanding of the actual fundamental principles that govern enzyme function. The fact that this totally synthetic, completely made-up protein is able to perform the exact chemistry it was actually designed to catalyze demonstrates that we really do have a decent grasp on the basics of how enzymes work and can apply these concepts to create proteins that perform specific reactions.
And not only that, to do so, I mean, once we get this understanding, much more efficiently. I mean, one of the big issues these days is the idea of biofuels and trying to create enzymes that will create gasoline or what have you from organic material. Nature does it, but it doesn't do it as nearly as efficient as we'd like it to do. So in creating these artificial enzymes, we can sort of tweak it to the point where it becomes hyper efficient and it'll be much more better. Or as Ethan was talking about there before, when nature doesn't do it correctly mm-hmm. for some disease or what have you, mm-hmm. we have the ability to step in and A, know what's wrong with you, and B, perhaps have a treatment in order to correct that via some other means.
Well, yeah, one of the thing with the enzyme they actually chose is carbonic anhydrase. It's not so much that it's not fast enough, because this is actually one of the faster reactions we even know about as far as enzymes performing. It's pretty much limited by diffusion. It's super duper fast. But by copying this enzyme, what it does is allows us to test these principles with some kind of benchmark. So you're actually saying, you know, if you're designing an enzyme from scratch and it works, great, but how do you evaluate how well that actually works? So because we have a natural enzyme that does it so quickly, we know that that chemistry at that speed is actually possible. Whereas if you do it a completely novel reaction, there's no way to really evaluate that, so there's no way to tell whether or not you're designing it particularly well and your design principles are well-founded. However, you can take what you were saying, Don, even a step further. Instead of performing reactions, designing enzymes to perform reactions that already exist but do them faster, this kind of work is what's leading us toward designing enzymes to perform reactions that have never been performed. So like I said earlier, we're creating all kinds of chemicals and stuff that are brand new to the environment, and evolution hasn't really had a chance to catch up and to develop enzymes that are able to, you know, deal with a lot of pollutants, so to break down styrofoam, to deal with a lot of different things. And now this type of research is testing the principles and applying them for the very first time to allow us to be able to design novel enzymes that are not based on anything we know to do reactions that no one has ever seen before.
But aren't you risking someone, you know, using your bean a G, you know?
A what?
You know, the G word.
Oh, are you saying that I'm playing God?
Well, some people might say that. They do that with genetically modified foods. I don't see how.
Oh, don't even get me on that.
Enhanced enzymes would not sort of fall into that same.
Well, see, I don't actually like to think of this as playing God so much as playing evolution, or at least learning from it.
I like that. Well, let's go to another commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and when we come back, we'll dive in to the recent CFI Canada conundrum here on Radio Free Thinker.
In this spot, standing on a planet, really I'm just a speck, compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
We'd like to take a moment to thank businesses who have made generous donations to FundDrive 2011. Thank you to Fortune Sound Club,
The Cobalt,
Lotus Land Tattoo,
Restricted Entertainment,
and Sanitary Electric Tattoo Company for helping us continue to provide quality alternative programming from 2011 and into the future.
We'd also like to thank our volunteer sponsors, Bilo Foods and Ethical Bean, for keeping our volunteers sated and caffeinated.
We here at CITR cannot do it without your support, so thank you. If you'd like to donate to CITR's Fund Drive 2011, call 604-822-8648. That's 604-822-8648. Or go online to citr.ca/funddrive today. Get up, stand
up, get up. And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So,
I don't get into local social gossip that much recently, but for one reason or another, I was cruising the interweb again, and I came across a blog post by a local person in the know in the skeptic community, and he was talking about how there's some, well, things going on, for lack of a more
definitive
salient
word.
Going on at CFI, and I think things is the best word for it, because no one quite knows what is going on, but everyone seems to have an opinion, and there are parts of the story here and parts of the story here. Ethan, you've had a bit of a history with CFI, and you kind of know some things. And I think some of the comments I heard were actually kind of directed at you indirectly as part of the whole thing. But you were telling me that stuff is going down at CFI. What's all up with that?
Well, yeah. I mean, let's be honest. The last few weeks, or some people would even say months, have not been the best for CFI Canada. From listeners who don't know, CFI Canada, aka the Centre for Inquiry, is an educational charity here in Canada with a mandate to promote skepticism, critical thinking, and secular values.
And I think important to note is an off-branch of the American CFI International, so this is like our local branch of it.
Well, I wouldn't say it's a local branch. CFI Ontario began as a branch of CFI Transnational. That branch of CFI Ontario eventually became an independent entity and sprouted, you know, CFI Vancouver, CFI Calgary, and so forth, and eventually morphed into CFI Canada.
Is it still under the umbrella of CFI Transnational?
Yes and no, but we'll get to that in a bit. Now, in all fairness, we've talked about CFI many times on our show, and often very positively with regards to events, activism, and skeptical outreach. However, as I mentioned, things haven't been going too well right now. Locally here in Vancouver, there was an unfortunate split between CFI Vancouver and the Reasonable Women Group, which kind of made a dent in the solidarity of the local community of free thinkers here. But meanwhile, serious problems were happening at the top of CFI's organizational structure. And these problems were mostly happening in secret from many volunteers and members of the organization. Many listeners may have already been following the story, and there's been lots of blog posts written about this so far. There's also been a fair share of speculation, guesses, rumors, and mudslinging. In order to get the most accurate picture I could, I tried to rely on what I've been told by board members and volunteers just directly involved, and looking at official CFI correspondence that comes my way as an advisor and associate member to the organization. I can't guarantee that this chain of events is 100% accurate or that small details are being left out, but I'm reasonably confident in what I'm suggesting is a understandable course of events. And as I was actually told by a board member, unless somebody has been present for the last few months meticulously taking notes, any account of what happened is bound to have a few mistakes in it. So,
and we are open. People who have their own particular opinion about this, they have information that they would like people to know that they can be verified, please let us know at info@radiofreethinker.com. We will be spouting a bunch of information here, but as a good skeptic, we're always open to other points of view or corrections or amendments, so please let us know. We are here to help reflect your own sensibilities as well as our own.
Right, so let's start with where the problems seemed to begin, and that was late September, maybe early September, when it was revealed that the National Executive Director of CFI, Justin Trottier, had left the organization. Details of Trottier's departure wasn't made public, but many, myself included, thought that Justin had decided to move on, perhaps pursuing a career in politics. Justin did pursue...
He did run for the Green Party in Ontario, and sadly, or goodly, depending on your point of view, is politics.
Well...
He didn't win.
Yeah, I mean, the Green Party is... It's not the best party to win with. But anyway, never mind that. Leadership of CFI passed to Derek Pert, who was formerly the executive director of CFI Ontario. However, it soon became apparent that Justin didn't leave of his own accord. He was fired by the board of directors. The exact reason is unclear. And there are rumors or speculation and there's accusations, but I haven't been able to verify any of them, so I'm not going to report on them as though they were clear. It also appeared that the decision to fire Justin wasn't universally agreed to by the board of directors. In fact, it may have been done in a way that violated the bylaws of the organization. Again, there's some disagreement about how on the level Justin's termination was or was not, but that seems to be a point of contention.
Now, do we have any idea what the two sides of that argument are? Like, any specifics at all about what parts of their rules may have been violated or any...
Or even the point, rumors, that because he was running for political office and head of a nonprofit organization, that caused some other areas of conflict. Not being a lawyer, I don't know how valid those particular concerns would have been.
I'm just wondering if we have any inkling of any of the specific points on that.
Well, I can elaborate based on what I've heard. One suggestion I heard was that there was a decision made to sort of take CFI in a new direction, and some board members felt that Justin's skill set did not sync up with this new direction.
So that would be like a legit reason to dismiss someone, yes?
In theory, yes, but in order to get this passed, they proposed a resolution. But they didn't explicitly state that Justin was to be terminated, but rather kind of included that as sort of, I guess you could call it the fine print.
So sort of like vote conservative and we'll get rid of the wheat board?
In theory. And the idea being that certain board members were kind of duped into voting for this that would fire Justin.
Wasn't there also part of this sort of thing rebranding a large donation in order to actually...
Yeah, we'll cover that in a bit as well. Now, the other side of that argument is that evidence was brought forward that Justin was not following proper rules, that he had made mistakes, I think, out of ignorance, not maliciousness, and that the board was required to terminate him. And so there is some debate about whether or not who knew about what and what their motives were.
So Justin was fired.
Justin was fired.
Okay.
Now... What is definitely clear is that the board is in disagreement about whether or not that was the right decision. It's also very clear that the board is not unified on this controversial plan to review and potentially change the direction and mission statement of CFI Canada, and this created a rift in the board of directors, and they weren't able to pass resolutions because they couldn't agree on anything.
So again, I understand the concept of there being a rift between the two groups. Do you know changing sort of the gist of the mission statement from what to what?
I don't really have a clear idea on that.
And okay.
That's going to come into the debate a bit later on, because a lot of the debate about changing the mission statement was being done behind closed doors, not involving the membership base, not really involving local volunteers.
What is the membership base again? Sorry, that was another issue that I had heard that made it interesting, that although I'm a member of CFI, I'm actually not a member of CFI. I am a friend of CFI.
Yeah.
Which essentially means I'm entitled to discounts, but I'm not really entitled to a voice above and beyond what they're willing to listen to.
Yeah, that's a complicated issue, and I don't have an answer for that one.
And don't get me wrong. To be fair, I mean, Ethan does not represent CFI. He likes CFI. He's pro-CFI. I'm not trying to ask. If anyone out there has a good answer, please let us know.
Yeah. So, that's always been a bit of a question mark. I was always told that, well, CFI wasn't like democratic. They considered the Friends of the Center to be members. But again, that's probably open for debate. Now, to get back to our story here, all of this sort of debate and conflict was happening in secret, and the average volunteer member had no idea. This was compounded when notices were sent out to the public from various board members, seemingly without the approval of the rest of the board, and potentially containing misleading statements, namely that Justin was fired by unanimous decision, that here were the reasons, etc., etc. So this has led to a lot of questions about why was Justin fired? Was it a good reason? Was he a good leader? And these are all questions that people all over the Canadian skeptical, you know, blog sphere and the various centers are asking themselves. Now, to say that Justin was at times controversial is an understatement. Justin was an advocate for men's rights and was known to have a very deeply driven personality, which some people found difficult to work with. Now, out of respect for Justin, I don't think he would disagree with this sentiment. I think he would acknowledge that he could sometimes rub people the wrong way. I think he was fully aware of that. But it's also important to point out that Justin made the free thought movement in Canada. He took CFI from being a small branch of CFI Transnational to a national movement here in the country, and he is really an incredibly accomplished activist and has made hundreds of media appearances, and he put in significant work into building CFI. So I think the issue here should be about whether or not Justin was removed in a legal way. Whether or not we agree with his politics or opinions, I think is less important, so a bit important, but less important. The question is, was Justin fired in a way that broke the rules?
Mm-hmm.
So what do you guys think about that?
Well, I mean, as much as I would like to give him praise for helping found the movement in here, we don't want to, just because he was sort of the Peter of the skeptical movement, doesn't give him a special place in
the
our...
Peter?
Well, Peter founded the Catholic Church.
I'm going to go with Steve Jobs.
Okay, Steve Jobs.
That's actually not a bad analogy, I guess.
he was also fired from his own company.
He was. That's true. So I think it's being sort of a bad skeptic to say that someone should get a pass just because of their, you know, it's what you have done, what you are doing now. That's important. It's the issues that are important, not the personality.
His overall fireability, though, isn't really that sort of pertinent to whether or not he was fired in a way that is legally allowable by the bylaws of the organization. You know, whether or not we think he should be fired or should be given a pass or whatever based on his prior achievements with the organization doesn't really tell us much about the way in which it all went down.
Yeah, and I think as far as regards to the legality of it, which, I mean, has its place, that deals more with, is he entitled to a severance package versus not? I mean, if he doesn't work with at least half of the board or plus, it doesn't seem like a good fit, no matter what you're dealing with, right?
On the other hand, it sort of seems like, well, I don't know much about the situation. I guess not that many people know that much about the situation. But as far as if something went down that was not out in the open to the board members that were actually in the room, as far as, you know, when you were mentioning that there was some question of some sort of misleading motions and that kind of thing, that that would clearly be not in good faith as far as the democratic principles as they are within the board itself.
Which, of course, leads to, that's another issue, which I guess maybe we'll talk about later, or we'll skip. Are the board members themselves, should they still be board members? I mean, maybe you can, you know this. How are these board members selected? And I don't remember ever voting for these board members, so...
Yeah, well, that's one of the big points that's been coming up recently, is that CFI is not a democratic organization and that the members don't vote on board members and they don't vote on the executive in any way. Board members are selected essentially by the board, and then the board of themselves votes on, do we make this person a board member or not? So, and this has also been a complaint many times lobbed at CFI Transnational. It's essentially the same style of organization. And we'll dive into that a bit in a bit as well.
And isn't there a big conflict of interest? Because isn't one of the major donors and board members the uncle of Justin?
Yeah, and we'll get to that in a moment.
Let's get on with this, Ethan. Jesus, you slow things down so much.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
Did you just blasphemize on the air, Don?
I don't know.
As this disagreement and debate continued, the problems of CFI started to get public attention. Concern on the parts of members over the lack of progress on the Extraordinary Claims Campaign, CFI's recent failure to meet a fundraising goal, which is the first time in CFI Canada's history, and that goal would have allowed CFI to get physical offices, meeting space in Vancouver, Calgary, or Montreal. And the controversial new mission statement that seemed to be implying a stop to activism and secular advocacy, and again, that's very fuzzy as well. Recently, a letter was published by the board of directors to announce some interesting developments. I'm going to quote that letter here. On November 21st, Derek Pert wrote to the board requesting that he be terminated with severance. Derek indicated that he thought he lacked sufficient support from the board to carry out his duties. The board held an emergency meeting on the evening of Wednesday, November 23rd. There followed a motion to terminate Derek Pert with a severance of $50,000. The motion was made by Michael Gardner. The motion was properly seconded and a vote was taken. The motion failed 6-3 with Michael Gardner, Ian McQuaig, and board chair Carol Parlow voting for the motion. Late on the night of November 23rd, Derek submitted a letter of resignation. On November 24th, in quick succession, directors Martin Gagnier, Ian McQuaig, and board chair Carol Parler submitted their letters of resignation. Longtime volunteer Michael Payton has been appointed interim national executive director. And that's happened quite recently. The board has pledged more accountability and transparency going forward. However, in rapid succession, more resignations have been made. The CFI Vancouver Executive Director has resigned, as well as co-chair of CAS, the Committee for the Advancement of Scientific Skepticism, Michael Cruz. And in addition, a number of volunteers have left the organization.
So the total structure is completely disintegrating.
It's disintegrating, but there at least is some clear directive of where they have to go at the moment. CFI has to replace several key positions, including staff, board members, and key volunteers. There are the additional questions / accusations that the board or certain members have acted inappropriately. This would include the notion that Justin was potentially fired illegally and that there was a conflict of interest since one of the board members was Lauren Trottier, Justin's uncle, and that he might have used his position as a donor to leverage support for Justin, which is what Don was mentioning earlier before. So all of that leaves us with some interesting questions to be asked about CFI and its future direction. And I've thought of a few maybe questions that we can dive into this with. And one is, could CFI's problems be solved by switching to a democratic system where members voted for board directors?
You know, actually, I think in an odd sort of way, because they have so many board members to be filled, that this would be, I mean, at least as an experiment. So they sort of have the non-elected board members, that are there that can make sure this process goes forward, and have at least half the board, it's about half the board members, if I'm correct, that left?
Three have left.
Out of?
Nine.
So at least have these ones as sort of a test case to say, okay, let's have these board members elected. Let's see if we can do this and have it actually be effective as, again, a test case. I mean, it seems like an excellent opportunity.
And I would also point out, Don, you mentioned the CFI transnational connection. When CFI Canada first formed, three of the board members were members of CFI Transnational. Ron Lindsay, who is the CEO of CFI Transnational, he's the leader of that organization, as well as Barry Carr, who is the man behind Skeptical Inquirer magazine, and Tom Flynn, who is the man behind Free Inquiry magazine. Barry resigned months ago for unrelated reasons. He was, I think, just swamped with work. Ron and Tom still remain on the board, and from what I understand, have frequently abstained from any voting on any of these issues previously. So the American representatives on the board have, for the most part, stayed out of the affairs of CFI Canada.
And a part of the reason why the American members are there is CFI still gets some funding from the parent organization. They're trying to wean them off the teat, so to speak, but it's still, they still have an interest, so they still think they should have representation. Jenna, you get squirrely faces when I mentioned that this would be an opportunity for democracy. Are you anti-democratic?
No, I'm anti a board that's half democratic, half appointed with no formal difference in their roles or designations, just because I think that can create as much sort of intra-board politics as anything else.
So, I mean, perhaps
so
then
all or nothing.
That's kind of my feeling, just because at least everyone's on the same playing field.
Nullifying the board and then re-voting everyone back in.
Or keeping the system as it is, because, I mean, as we've learned from democracy in general all over the place, you know, sometimes if you have responsible, well representative voters, then it works really well. And if for some reason the voter turnout is either, it can be very skewed toward, you know, one agenda or another, or one demographic or another, then you might end up with a board that's not fully representative of its membership. Although you could argue, of course, that the membership that deserves to be represented is those that vote.
Yeah, I was going to say, in an odd sort of way, I don't see how this is representative at all. In a way, you kind of have the old boys network, even though they're not all boys.
I totally agree. I guess what I'm trying to say is that I don't think that just putting a blanket democratization is a silver bullet.
No, and sorry, that's why I thought this was a perfect opportunity, is you could sort of test the mechanism out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if there was some horrible side effect, you go, okay, we tried it, it didn't work, or B, this is what we need to do if we're going to make the whole board democratic.
And I think if you're going to do that, you would have to formalize the positions and actually have two different designations of board positions that are not just the history of how they got there, but actually designated, like, appointed board member versus elected board member, and have there be potentially either different roles, different responsibilities, or different sort of strata in those positions.
Well, the other point is, I mean, with, like most educational or charities in general, board members are typically made up of the top donors. And not that I'm suggesting that this is the case, but if somebody, say, donates $50,000 to CFI and I donate $20, should my vote be on equal footing with their donation? I mean, if they're contributing 80% of CFI's operating budget, do they not get a say proportional to what they donated?
I think that's up to the organization to lay out at the onset. Like, you can't make those decisions partway through. You really have to say, you know, you can donate as much as you want, but this is how our organization is run. Or, yes, you know, your donations help you have a say in what happens in our organization.
And to go on that same bent, you have to be careful how far you go down that road. Because from what I understand, CFI has a plethora of volunteers.
And from what I understand, the Catholic Church has a lot of money.
But they have a lot of volunteers, and so if I donate, you know, my time, and my time is worth, let's say I'm an engineer and I get paid $50 an hour, I gave, you know, I donated 1,000 hours this year to CFI, does that mean I get $50,000 worth of voting rights? I think that's where $1, one vote in any institution can break down. I understand, as a donator, I think I should have a bigger say. But in an odd sort of way, you do get a bigger say, because as you're donating the check, the board of directors, be they elected or otherwise, are going to want to listen to the big donators mm-hmm. because they want you to keep donating. And in that sense, that compensates for the sort of skewing that you were mentioning, that should a $20 person have the same vote as a $20,000 person? Yes, they should have the same vote, but obviously the way the world works, they're never going to have the same influence.
Yeah. Well, that actually leads to the next question relating to the notion of the mandate review. And there's been some suggestion, although I haven't been able to confirm this actually happened, that the mandate review was brought about because a donor donated $20,000 specifically for the purpose of review CFI's mandate and come to some conclusion. I'm really skeptical of the so-called, you know, we're going to review our mandate and come up with some, like, radical new statement. Because to me, that always kind of sounds like, you know, Coca-Cola saying our bold new strategy is to sell more Coke.
Or worse, Pepsi saying we're going to come up with Crystal Pepsi because it's clear it's got to be better. It's like, no, it may have looked good for marketing, but stick with what you do it well. And
on the other hand, if it really, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. If it really was worded the way you said it, as far as review it and come to some conclusion, that is fairly open-ended as far as reviewing. Yes, that still fits our member base. Yes, that still fits what we want to accomplish versus, I mean, you can think of any number of companies that have changed their mandates over the years.
Yeah, and I don't know if that was the wording. It could have been, here's $20,000, review your mission statement
and change it.
That's different. And you know, I mean, this segues into that big conversation of the skeptical movement. What is the best way of doing things? And for a very long time, CFI has straddled that boundary of grassroots organization and sort of top-down executive control. And, you know, the scuttlebutt is that the big question is, should CFI switch to a more skeptical, advocacy-focused, professional look, a.k.a. maybe like the JREF, or do they need to focus more on a secular advocacy look, maybe like the Richard Dawkins Foundation, or do they continue with business as usual and sort of meld the two into that big tent, we do local community events, and we do advocacy, and we do all of the above?
I don't know. As you say, it seems like there are two separate jobs there, but we're Canada. And because we have a smaller population base, we tend not to have enough dollars to go around to fund everything the way it should be funded. And there is a certain amount of synergy by having sort of one organization trying to do both jobs to a certain degree. But again, one of the things that I've always admired and enjoyed with CFI is the fact that it's bringing skepticism to your community. It is bringing speakers. It is bringing things that will actually interact and interfere with my life in a good way. And that seems
constructive interference.
Yeah, because I mean, as far as the big issues kind of go, one, maybe in the good way, we get a lot of spillover from the States. So as far as, you know, organizations that are trying to work on something like global warming or something like that, you know, the science-based approach or something like that, a lot of advocacy can be gotten from American spillover. But where we don't get the spillover is in the communities, in the local thing. And that's, again, where I think, you know, having a membership-based voting sort of idea, not only does it make it more accountable and more representative, but it gives people sort of a buy-in. This is my organization. And you're still always going to have the big donors who are going to say, listen, I'll give you $100,000 to put things on a bus. And you go, well, okay, thanks, we'll put it on a bus. Right? There's no, it doesn't mean you can't do that sort of thing. But I think it's the grassroots organization that is the biggest thing. I mean, let's look at churches. I mean, churches do they have such a foothold in communities, not because they have governmental lobbyists, they have such a foothold, mm-hmm. is because they have church on every freaking corner you look at. They're having bake sales every week. They're giving soup to homeless people, right? It is the in-community work that makes movements like CFI, like skepticism, important to people's life. And I mean, if I had to choose between one of the two, I think that's really where they should be putting their effort.
Yeah. And I think that regardless of where anyone would fall on that debate, I think everyone should agree that if it's going to happen, it should happen
above
in
board.
Conversation with the membership, not just sort of behind closed doors and then here it is, take it or leave it.
Yeah, I mean, what are they worried about? That our competition are going to steal some sort of state secrets? That's
been one of sort of the ongoing complaints is why all the secrecy.
Yeah.
But again, so that's our take on the CFI fiasco. If you want to yell at us, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com and feel free to have at us.
Yes.
Well, we're pretty much out of time, so let's quickly go to our skeptical highlights. I just have one. I want to give a shout-out to the Abbotsford Skeptics Group. They meet up every Sunday at noon at Legal Grounds Coffee. It's a friendly, casual event to hang out with other local skeptics in the Abbotsford community. Good work, guys.
I have a long one I'm going to save for next week, but I will point out that we did get some listener feedback about a comment I made in last episode. It was about shark finning, and it came across as a bit flippant, and I didn't mean for it. So I wrote a blog post that kind of clarified my position on it and what I actually think about what is the atrocity of finning in
shark
society.
Shark finning equal bad.
Yes. So I go to our website, look at the blog. It's called The Finning, a Horror Story, which I guess gives you a slightly slight idea of what it's about. So I would go do that.
Again, completely unbiased.
Any skeptical highlights, Jenna?
Tell me your favorite breakfast place. I know mine.
Okay, well, that's a good one. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds open.
And as always, this is Jenna. The real world is amazing.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise.